I saw a study by the Search Institute recently in which staff people at various churches were asked this question. How much difficulty do you have, or do you have difficulty, hanging on to your fifth and sixth graders? And then they were asked, do you have difficulty hanging on to your 10th through 12th graders? I don't have the numbers right here in front of me, but I'll bet you can predict the results. When they ask, how many of you have a great deal of trouble, how many of your churches have a great deal of trouble hanging on to your 5th and 6th graders? Only 8% of churches said that they had a great deal of trouble hanging on to their 5th and 6th graders. When they ask the question, how many of you have a great deal of trouble hanging on to your 10th through 12th graders? Over 50% of churches said we have a great deal of trouble hanging on to our 10th through 12th graders. As a matter of fact, 93% of churches said they have at least some trouble hanging on to their 10th through 12th graders. The figure was around the 50% area as they thought about hanging on to their 5th and 6th graders. The implication of that may be obvious, but let me draw it out. The implication is that doing youth ministry, hanging on to young people, particularly in this culture, is going to be a very difficult operation. I know I'm speaking the obvious to most of you. But the truth is, one of the things our sessions need to understand, or the leadership of our church needs to understand, is that youth ministry is a challenge across the board. Over 90% of churches are having the very same problem. Well, one of the implications for me then is that youth ministry is an expensive enterprise. Now, there are two ways to look at expense. One is to look at it in terms of money. Lyle Schaller, a number of years ago, wrote a book called Lessons of a Contrarian. And in that book, he suggested that it's not uncommon for a church to spend $500 per year per active young person in the church. Now, that you do the math on that. If you want to have 100 active young people, you have a budget of $50,000 if you're using Schaller's numbers. Now, that's probably over a decade ago when those numbers were researched and found out. Now, here's what I've discovered, and that is that the larger the church is, the more expensive that is. In other words, I've found that the larger churches tend to pay between $1,000 and $1,500 per active young person. Often a smaller church that has a handful of young people, often because they can't afford to hire a full-time person to create a program for kids to learn to be reactive Christians from, often they're able to hang on to kids in a less expensive way, let's say, anyway. We'll talk about that further as we start talking about this whole family-based paradigm and different models for ministry. But I think that's helpful to know. The implication is that youth ministry across the board is difficult. One other survey, George Barna, surveyed in the Index of Leading Spiritual Indicators, asked what do churches do best and what do churches do worst. One of the things that he found out was churches, by and large, what they do best is that they are friendly. And what he found out was that the one thing churches do worst is that they is creating programs for teenagers. Now, we just have to acknowledge that across the board in this country, churches are struggling with hanging on to their young people. Some churches have sufficiently capitalized their programs, recognizing that it's a challenge, and are having some significant success in their work. But the bottom line is most churches are struggling with the very same issues, and we just need to be aware of that. There was a book called Vanishing Boundaries. And in Vanishing Boundaries, the researchers tracked young people who had been confirmed in the life of the church as young people. Somehow, they were able to track them for 20 years out. Now, there are fascinating statistics surrounding that, but the one that was most striking to me was simply this, that 20 years out, over 50% of those young people who had made professions of faith to Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior, over 50% of them now classify themselves as unchurched. Now, to me, there's something wrong with our system. There's something wrong with the way that we're doing youth ministry if we're not leading them to mature Christian adulthood. One additional survey by the Roper survey people, what they have discovered, they've tried to measure the percentage, or sort of by decades, percentage of a generation, for example, the 20 people in their 20s or people in their 30s, by generation, how are they more or less active in the church than that generation was, say, 10 years ago? What they found out was that it's only the older generations that are actually increasing in involvement. The younger generations are decreasing. Something is wrong with the way we're doing youth ministry. Well, that's the That's the image that I have, and this is not original with me. I've talked with many youth ministers that have kind of come up with the same image, that youth ministry today is in midlife crisis. Now, midlife crisis is when a person, classically, as it talks about men in our culture, it is moving from a point of having been successful and then wondering, well, where is all this success getting me? Moving from, as Mr. Buford has said, Bob Buford has said, moving from success to significance. I want to not just be successful. I want my success to be in something that matters. And I think that's a great image for where youth ministry today is. We're trying to move away from just knowing how to be successful, which we've done quite well, learning how to be significant, make a significant impact. Okay, with those kind of as the description of the crisis in youth ministry, let me give just a few implications for ministry, okay? The first is that now, more than ever, our churches need to concentrate on numbers, particularly keeping track of our teenagers, making every effort to provide a faithful ministry to the students that God gives the church. In other words, most churches are often so busy, most traditional youth programs are so busy trying to get other kids involved that they often don't keep track of where their own kids are. You'll never find a shepherd that does that with his sheep, but we do that with our kids. The second is, because faith maturity develops as young people are encouraged in their faith, churches can work to provide all their teenagers with some sort of ministry of their own. We can find some way to plug our kids into doing something where they're making a contribution. And thirdly, realistically, only a limited number of teenagers can be given leadership in the youth program. But most teenagers can be given a ministry alongside adults in the church, a ministry that benefits someone other than the youth. Now, because I believe that these are years of bold experimentation in youth ministry, I want to offer at the end of each section, I want to offer a wild hair. Just in case there are churches that want to try something a little bit crazy. What I'm suggesting is that churches, there will be some churches who won't be afraid to step back from some of the sacred cows of Sunday school and youth group in order to try to develop a ministry to teenagers that is designed to build long-term faith. So I'm going to give some of those at the end of each chapter. Now we're going to move into a section where we identify some of the roots of this crisis in youth ministry. And again, as we begin each section, I want to give you just a few thoughts to chew on, some thoughts from folks around the country, around the world perhaps, who have some insights related to this topic. The first is from Edward, Duke of Windsor, who died in 1997, was born in 1895. Here's what he said. The thing that impresses me the most about America is the way parents obey their children. Then from a report of the Carnegie Council on Adolescent Development, adolescence has become a waiting period of enforced leisure with few responsibilities and little or no meaningful contact with adults. Then Princeton University ethicist Paul Ramsey says, ours is the only era in the entire history of human life on this planet in which the elders of the tribe ask its newer members what the tribal rules and standards of expected behavior ought to be. Gordon MacDonald says, more often than not, children are learning major value systems in life from a horizontal peer culture. The vertical structure is not there in adequate increments of time or intensity to do the job. Stephen Glenn and Jane Nelson, in their fabulous book, Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World, they say, when peers have dialogue primarily with peers, they fail to be exposed to those with more advanced insights or more deeply developed faculties. Our children, who are constantly engrossed in peer-centered activities, interact minimally with those more mature than themselves. And finally, Quentin Schultz and crew, who wrote the book Dancing in the Dark, they say, the culture of the electronic media prescribes perpetual adolescence and consumption as developmental ideals. Indeed, perpetual adolescence and consumption constitute the twin-pronged gospel of these media. So let's take a look at the crisis in terms of looking beneath the crisis at what are the roots, what is the cause. Well, most of us would admit that teenagers today are in trouble, and what they don't know can literally kill them. Our culture sends its kids into adulthood ill-prepared for the increasing demands of our complex society. Like so many children in the Middle East who defend themselves by throwing rocks at soldiers with machine guns, this generation of kids enters the confusing battleground of adulthood armed with nothing more than vague values and innocuous religious experiences. As in any war, there have been casualties. Teenagers are dying at a higher rate than they were 30 years ago, victims of accidents, suicide, homicides, drugs, and alcohol. While the members of every other age group are more likely to live than they were 30 years ago, adolescence has become for many a life and death obstacle course. Most of us who work with teenagers have heard the negative statistics, but we don't have to read them to know they're true. We're not surprised to learn that the number of teenagers committed to institutions in the last decade has risen by 400%. Or that in 1995, 53,000 teenagers died in the United States. By comparison, by the way, 56,000 Americans died in 5 years in Vietnam. We work with a teenage boy who's been in and out of rehab 3 times. We visited the hospital where one of our college girls rotates on comatose on a board for months because of an accident after drinking at a fraternity party. We've stood beside enough graves to know that something is very wrong. Social scientists and armchair politicians all seem to have their explanations, from the deterioration of public education to the breakdown of the American family. Without a doubt, no single factor is entirely responsible for the frightening situation faced by our teenagers. But I believe a single trend in our culture has, more than any other factor, precipitated the crisis. And until we take this trend seriously, our ministry to young people will be severely limited in its impact. I want to talk about this crisis in terms of arenas, the different places our young people find themselves. In a recent research project, a group of 75 suburban teenagers were given beepers and belts and asked to write down exactly what they were doing and feeling at the exact moment the beeper sounded. After several months of observation, the results gave a portrait of how teenagers spend their time. The single most disturbing conclusion recorded in the book Being Adolescent was the unprecedented neglect of teenagers by adults. The study documented the very large amount of time that teenagers spend alone and dangerously limited contact they actually have with adults. Teenagers are increasingly isolated from the adult world, and even when young people are with adults, it's usually in a large group setting in which the teenagers are being entertained, informed, or directed by those adults, leaving little opportunity for dialogue and collaboration required for youth to learn adult values. Cornell University's Uri Bronfenbrenner cites 9 specific changes that have taken place during the past generation which have increasingly separated children and youth from the world of adults, especially the adults in their own families. Let me give you those quickly. Number 1. Fathers' vocational choices, which remove them from home for lengthy periods of time. Number 2, an increase in the number of working mothers. Number 3, a critical escalation in the divorce rate. Number 4, a rapid increase in single-parent families. And number 5, a steady decline in the extended family. Number 6, the evolution of the physical environment of the home. In other words, family rooms, playrooms, master bedrooms. Number 7, the replacement of adults by the peer group. Number 8, the isolation of teenagers from the adult work world. And number 9, the insulation of schools from the rest of society. The last factor caused Bronfenbrenner to describe the current U.S. educational system as, quote, one of the most potent breeding grounds for alienation in American society. When he wrote those words in 1974, this trend toward isolation was in full swing, and it has not been significantly checked since that time. In neighborhoods, in schools, in social activities, their own families, and even at church, young people are afforded less and less opportunity to be with adults. Let's talk about neighborhoods. To begin with, consider the mere physical changes in neighborhoods over the past generations. Many of the newer subdivisions have sidewalks that connect each house only to its own driveway. Few neighborhoods today still have even the visible connection of sidewalks between neighbors. I grew up in a Presbyterian manse. Next door to our home was Mr. Flanders' Schwinn Bike Shop. When I had nothing to do, which was often, I would travel the sidewalk over to Mr. Flanders, shake at his coin collections, or run my fingers over the new bikes. You know, honestly, I don't remember one thing he ever said to me, but I do remember he was someone who let me peek in to what it was like to be an adult. I was not particularly close to Mr. Flanders. He was not a mentor, but he was part of my developmental landscape, an entree into the adult world. He was a part of my cloud of witnesses. Children and teenagers in our culture are more and more removed from this kind of adult, an adult that they know for free, not a tutor or a teacher or a parent or a babysitter or even a youth leader. Many children have their schedules so packed that even if adults were available, there'd be little opportunity to spend time with them. From organized sports leagues to the growing amount of homework many schools are giving, teens have little time to do anything but check their schedules and run. Most young people grow up in neighborhoods populated by wandering children and dogs, but very few visible adults. Sadly enough, the closest thing that some children have to an available adult is 911. How about schools? And incidentally, when I present these principles to a group, often what I will do is put a graph on the board and I'll say, in terms of what percentage of time young people spend with adults and without adults, I'll do each one of these arenas. Interestingly enough, almost every time the huge majority of the group says, and I always give them the grace on the other side, I always put a higher number than they even guessed. Every time I say what percentage of time are kids spending in intentional dialogue with adults, for example, in neighborhoods, and they'll throw out a statistic. Across the country, what we're seeing is the vast majority of kids' time is not interacting with adults. Incidentally, I know I'm interrupting myself again, but when I teach our young people here, I do a Bible study on Psalm 1, and I paraphrase Psalm 1:1, which says, "Blessed is a man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers." And I paraphrase that by saying, essentially, the message there for us is, don't hang out with stupid people. Frequently, kids are in situations where, as Gordon MacDonald suggested, they're only learning horizontally. Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, has described that as a co-figurative culture, a culture in which the young people learn primarily from people at their level. And when that is the case, there's a huge limitation in what they can learn. If you only hang out with people who don't know anything or don't know any more than you do, chances are you won't learn much. Okay, so let's talk about schools. Schools have increasingly isolated junior high and high school students from the adult world. In some schools, teachers now have classes with as many as 40 students. With the classes and teachers changing every 50 minutes, it is rare, if not impossible, for the average student to have any individual time to talk with his or her teachers. Schools are no longer a place in which the less mature have the opportunity to interact with the more mature. Students are intentionally stratified to limit class groupings to only those with a certain range of ability. This horizontal peer culture, peer structure, may be seen as a more efficient way to teach, but this pattern prevents youth from developing the vertical relationships that will promote their maturity. Now, not only vertical in terms of people that know more than they, but also vertical relationships in terms of people that know less so that they can have the opportunity to teach them. A growing number of very committed teachers have a tremendous impact on the values of their students. But as a general rule, teachers simply don't have time for the non-directive conversations that will create, develop values and thinking skills with their kids. The majority of the time teenagers spend in schools is dedicated to isolated work alone and periodically with peers, but seldom in meaningful conversation with adults. Let's talk about social activities. Teenagers are also increasingly on their own when it comes to choosing social activities. Now, you can be in Pulaski, Tennessee, or you can be in New York, New York. Teenagers are going to make the same complaint. There's nothing to do in this town. Hanging out with friends or partying in an adult-free environment has become the norm of teenage social life. At one party, a fight broke out between kids at rival high schools. In the process, a high school boy was stabbed and subsequently died. In the following interviews with newspapers and the police, the parents who hosted the party were asked, "Where were you that evening?" Their answer, what gives a telling metaphor for us, they said, "We were upstairs. We just didn't want to get in the kids' way." Well, when adults choose to stay out of kids' ways, the consequences can be fatal. When I was a college student 15 or so years ago, my friends and I discovered this unusual place where children and teenagers could try on being adults. On Friday nights, we'd load up in my 1962 VW Bug and drive 20 miles to the American Legion Hall in Elk, Texas. Incidentally, Elk, Texas is where David Koresh and his group was. I don't know that I ever danced there with David. But every Friday night, they had country western dancing, kicker dancing. And none of us really liked the music much. But it was such a break from the pizza and movie monotony that we kept coming back month after month. And as I look back, I see now that Elk was one of the few places we can find 80-year-old sweethearts and 8-year-old puppy lovers having fun together. Now, there may still be places like that, like Elk, Texas, where our kids can go for fun, but I'm hard-pressed to think of one. Okay, how about families? Without question, the most damaging isolation that teenagers in our culture experience is in their own families. American parents spend less time with their children than do parents in any other country in the world, according to Harvard psychiatrist Armand Nicolai. 50 years ago, families worked and ate together by necessity. Teenagers and parents spent hours and hours together. In the process, young people could not avoid observing and listening in on the adult world. These experiences laid a natural track for adolescents to enter adulthood. Well, as families prospered, they no longer found it necessary to work and eat together. The natural bridge from childhood to adulthood was severely weakened, if not removed altogether. With 1 in 4 young people now indicating that they have never, this 25% of kids say, they have never had a meaningful conversation with their father. Is it any wonder that over 75% of teenagers surveyed in USA Today say they want their parents to spend more time with them? Andre Elion Brooks, and she's a New York Times journalist, in her eye-opening book called Children of Fast-Track Parents, describes her interviews with children and parents who seem to have it all. And here's what she says. "If there's one thing that constantly emerged from my conversations with children, it was a surprising undercurrent of aloneness, feelings of isolation from peers as well as parents despite their busy lives." There's also a fascinating book that I want to recommend to you by Mary Pfeiffer called The Shelter of Each Other. And Mary Pfeiffer, you probably know her name from the book Reviving Ophelia. But essentially, what one of the messages that Mary Pfeiffer is bringing, a very similar message to this course, actually, from a secular perspective. She's saying that this is not a time where we need to be in the job of helping kids separate from their enmeshed families. This is a time to connect kids to the most powerful source for building their character, their maturity, their resilience. And that is going to be their families and some sort of extended family for them. Well, how about the church? One would hope that the church could be the one place where kids could have some interaction with adults. You might hope that churches would stand in this gap and provide an environment in which children and youth could dialogue and collaborate with adults. But sadly enough, for many teenagers, the place they're most segregated from the world of adults is in their church. The churches with the more successful youth programs are particularly good at separating, isolating kids away from the adults. The most successful youth ministries have their own youth Sunday school, their own youth mission, youth small groups, youth evangelism teams, youth worship, youth budget, youth interns, youth committees, youth offerings, youth Bible studies, youth elders. Youth elders. Never did understand that one. It's sort of like jumbo shrimp, genuine imitation leather. Youth centers. We've got youth choir. We've got youth rooms, youth discipleship group, youth conferences, youth retreats, youth fundraisers, and my personal favorite, youth ministers. We've got everything in the youth ministry that the church has, and we can do it in a more fun and zippier way than we can do it in the big church. Why would kids want to be loyal and be involved in the larger life of the church when they can do it all in the youth ministry? Even when families do worship together, almost inevitably the parents sit together, the children are shuffled off to children's church, and the youth sit in the balcony somewhere. The church is the one place where teenagers could logically be linked to the world of adults, but for the most part, we miss the opportunity. I love Stuart Cummingbond's image of this isolation. He's created the image of a one-eared Mickey Mouse. Can you picture that in your mind? A big circle with a little circle on the side. He uses that figure to describe how in most churches, the youth ministry and the life of the whole church make only just tangential contact. I gotta tell you, I grew up in a small church whose youth program was a failure most of the time. Because our small Presbyterian church could never hold on to its part-time Baptist youth directors for long, you know who had to get involved? The pastor. The pastor and the older members of the congregation had to spend a lot of time with the youth. In our sporadic youth meetings, we played a lot of football and talked about sex more than we probably should have, had more lock-ins than I care to count. The program always seemed to be struggling. But because the youth program was so inconsistent, we were forced to be involved with the adults of the church. We were bored to tears in worship, but as a whole, almost every teenager in our group was in church every week. There was a clear sense of belonging to that place for every teenager in the church. Our little church wasn't successful enough in its youth ministry to experience the one-eared Mickey Mouse syndrome. But through my relationship with the pastor and even through the boring worship service, I saw and heard the gospel. As a matter of fact, it was in this church, after a typically mediocre youth Sunday, that Edna Lou Sullivan, the elderly woman in the church, pulled me aside and said, "Honey," I was expecting she was just going to be in my face and be really upset about what we'd done after assaulting them with our youth Sunday. She said, "Honey, you're going to be a minister someday." And she marched off. Now, 15 years later, I still consider her words one of the first steps in my call to ministry. The less capable a church is at programming for its kids, the more responsibility the youth themselves will be required to take. Now, there are worse things a church can do than providing miserable programs for them. Patently isolating them from Christian adults may top that list. Churches that use traditional models for youth ministry approach the task of working with teenagers much like a mechanic would. When a mechanic sees a problem in an engine, he isolates the problem and fixes it. When leaders in the church, churches around the United States began to see teenagers growing disinterest in the church, they responded like a good mechanic: isolate and fix. Church leaders assumed that if they could isolate the youth department into its own independent subgroup in the church, they would instill the values necessary for youth to grow to mature Christian adulthood. But the Christian community is not like a machine. The problem cannot be solved by isolation. As a matter of fact, this solution may have been worse than the original problem. You may remember that this whole model grows out of John Dewey's idea that adolescence is a period of crisis. And because it's a period of crisis, we've got to isolate our young people from the younger and the older because they're in crisis and they're going to flail around and they may hurt those other folks. And the whole idea of secondary education was pulling them out so that they can have their own experience there. And I think that grand experiment in education we're seeing has not worked terribly well. But particularly from theological perspective, because teenagers are an integral part of the body of Christ, we need to understand this problem not like a mechanic, but more like a physician might. The organ is removed. When an organ is removed from a living body, that organ dies, but sometimes the body dies along with it. Is that not a great image of what we're doing in the church? The same principle is true in the body of Christ. Whatever new models for youth ministry we develop, we've got to take seriously the fact that teenagers grow toward mature Christian adulthood as they're connected with the total body of Christ, not isolated from it. Now, before we move on to talk specifically about the impact of this isolation, before we talk about the implications for ministry that this isolation gives us, let me just throw in a few more illustrations that over the past few years that I have seen of how we patently isolate our kids. I want you to think of the youth movies that you know, the ones I'm thinking of, Pump Up the Volume and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Clueless, those kind of movies. I want you to think about the role that adults play in those movies. Now, I frequently will show clips of those movies and ask the group to say, what do you see in those movies that's common? And typically, someone points out there are very few adults floating around. And you may remember, you probably watch this, I'm sure, all the time, the show Saved by the Bell. Mr. Belding is the principal there, and in general, the only consistent adult character in the show. I remember one episode I was watching for my quiet time, and Mrs. Belding is about to have a baby. So Mrs. Belding comes into the school. And she tells Mr. Belding, I'm about to have this baby. Somehow, Mrs. Belding gets hooked up with Screech. You remember that very creative character. And they get on the elevator together. And as soon as the elevator starts to move, there is an earthquake. And the kids are screaming and running around the halls. Now, if you don't count Mrs. Belding, and you don't count Mr. Belding, who's hiding under his desk in his office while the kids are screaming up and down the halls, do you know how many adults are there, are seen while their kids are screaming down the halls during an earthquake? Zero. Not one. Not only is this whole image of kids being isolated one that they have themselves, not necessarily one that they've chosen, but it's also one that the media tends to affirm and sells to them as what ought to be normal. I'm thinking of Blossom, the sitcom Blossom, when she was struggling with the question about whether or not she should be sexually active at, I don't know, 14 or 15. You remember that scene where she and her father were leaving a funeral, and as they were leaving the funeral, she says to her dad, Dad, I need to make a decision, and I need your help. And her father says something like, honey, let me tell you, whatever it is, you just go for it, because I have learned over the years that there are things that I wish I had done that I regretted that I didn't do. And Blossom says something like, well, Dad, don't you think I should tell you what it is first? And he says, no, honey, I just am telling you, I think you need to just go for it. Whatever it is, just go for it. And the final scene, you see Blossom up in a room with a Dear Abby book, thumbing through the Dear Abby book, looking for some sort of advice from somebody who knows something. But again, a great picture of what our culture is doing to its kids. We neglect them and say, oh, teach yourself. I was in Brazil visiting a place called the City of Youth that works with street children in Brazil that brings them in, gives them a place to live. One of the things that I was struck by there was how those young people who had been living on the streets thrived in a context of order. They had certain rituals that they did every day that gave them a context of order. They had certain things that they wore that allowed them to really thrive. Part of what our culture has done is isolated our kids from the structures that give them a sense of who they are. And the rituals that they go through are often the things that give them a sense of identity and order. The one fascinating statistic, and I have not chased this down, but But I've heard recently that over 50% of college graduates are now coming home to stay at home for a year. Again, part of what we're seeing is kids are having all kind of trouble making it into adulthood. Well, I think that's enough to get us going on isolation. I want to talk about a few implications for ministry and give you a wild hair to go on. And then from here we'll go to the next tape and work on the impact of this isolation on teenagers. Here's the first implication idea. Try to go for 1 month without isolating teenagers from the rest of the church. Instead, integrate them with adults in every typical youth ministry setting. In other words, youth could join different adult Sunday school classes or adult small groups. They could help in the nursery, or teenagers could help in the children's classes. But the idea is just experiment for a month. Don't isolate them at all for a month and see how it goes. Okay? Number two, leaders could learn a great deal simply by finding out how many and which adults their teenagers spend their time with. A simple survey at the beginning of class asking kids to list every adult they talked with over the past month and how long they spent talking could be an informative tool, not only for the leaders, but also for the kids. And number three, establish a task force to determine ways the church can provide more opportunities for teenagers in the church to build relationships with adults in the church. Choose three priorities for the coming year and implement them or experiment with them. Part of what I've realized since writing the book is that the implementation process is a very long one. I often suggest a 4-year implementation process before a family-based youth ministry is really in place. Because when I say implement them, I realize often what that means is experiment with them until you find a fit for your church. Okay, here's the wild hair. Instead of having youth group one night, assign the kids the job of having a half an hour visit with some adult outside of their family. Wait to have youth group again until everybody has made their visits. Well, I'm excited to be on the road here with you on this course, and so blessings on you as you study and prepare, and we will talk next on the next tape about the impact that this isolation actually has on our young people.